This is The Guardian.
I'm Grace Dent, and this is Comfort Eating from The Guardian. A podcast where we pay homage to the lesser celebrated foods in life. Because even as a restaurant critic, I believe the food that matters most is often that snack you cobble together when you're curled up on the sofa. Each week, I ask my guest to lift the lid on what comfort foods have seen them through their lives. Because you can tell a lot about a person from what they eat behind closed doors.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, friends. You find me for the very last time this series in my kitchen. Yes, I know. I hear you up and down the country moaning for more. But do not fear too much, friends. Comfort Eating will be back later in the year. Now, I have a fabulous guest arriving in a minute for a chat and a plate of something hearty. Closing season 4 is none other than the actor James Norton. Yeah, that's right. James Norton from Happy Valley. Before he gets here, I'm just treating myself to a little January health kick pack of Snacker Jacks. They are a health food, aren't they? Just dipping them in absolutely delicious spicy tomato sauce. So Moorish. Not very good for my breath, though. Chances are you've seen James Norton on your telly, in the cinema, or on stage. His roles have included playing a sleuthing vicar in Grantchester, a prince in War and Peace, and as the absolutely despicable ex-convict Tommy Lee Royce in The Incredible Happy Valley, the third and final series of which is currently airing on Sunday nights. No, I won't be asking for spoilers. However, I may be asking for a ticket for his next gig, as later this year he'll be on stage in an adaptation of Hanyi Yanagihara's best-selling novel, A Little Life, which is nearly sold out, I hear. James now lives in London, but I'm looking forward to hearing about his youth in God's own country, North Yorkshire, the adventures that he had in his 20s, and how he balances life at home with his fiancé with being one of Britain's most in-demand actors. Oh, and what he likes to eat when he's on the couch in his gym jams. Time for one last little treat. That's really good. Oh my God. James Norton, welcome to Comfort Eating.
Thank you very much, Grace.
Welcome to my house.
Thank you. What lovely house you have.
Thank you very much. We have recorded 4 seasons of Comfort Eating here at my living room table. And I think that when having people around, everybody falls into 2 camps. Either you're a better host or a better guest. James Norton, which one are you?
100% a host.
Are you?
Yeah. I love hosting. And amongst my friends, I'm the guy who brings, you know, the big party, New Year or whatever it might be. I love it. I think I had a life as a prison chef, right? I can't cater for less than 10 people. So whenever I make anything, it's like ridiculous proportions, partly because I'm a glutton, but partly because, I just love people over.
But if I was at one of your dinner parties, how do I know that you actually want everyone to go home? It's time.
I don't. That's the other thing. I'm begging people to stay. My partner is in bed and is probably knocking on the floor saying fuck off. I am downstairs going, let's just have one more. So I'm definitely the guy who's not going to bed, and it's quite good because we come at life from two ends of that spectrum. But if it came to it, I guess I would. I'm pretty good at just saying go home now, because also I'm the guy who always hosts, so I can,
What, do you just open the doors and start ringing people to Uber?
Short of, yeah, I might just switch the music off, turn the lights on, that kind of thing.
James, you have brought your ultimate comfort snack for us to enjoy or endure, depending on what it is. Please unveil your snack. I have no idea what is under this pile of foil and tea towels.
I don't know where this sits in your hierarchy of a taste and controversial snacks. I mean,
I love how nervous people get before they unveil the snack. I love it. We have the greatest minds, celebrities through this door, and they crumble on taking a tea towel off a tray every time.
It's because in your intro you say what it says about the person. Nothing says more than what they eat in their private moments. And so I'm like, what does it say about me?
I do say that, James. Oh, I say, God. Because you can tell a lot by the snack that people I'm just doing my intro now.
You are.
They cobble together behind closed doors.
Oh, you're about to judge
me. I feel like you've kind of shrunk in stature since the beginning of this part.
No. When you eat this, I'm going to get my stature
Let's
back.
Let's do it. Wow. Yes.
It looks more simple than it is. It looks like...
Hang on, there's a random factor here. No, I'm going to describe what I can see in front of me. Yeah. It is two beautiful pieces of... I'm going to say sourdough bread.
Definitely.
It looks grilled, buttered.
Buttered, yeah.
There's a load of sliced, not mashed avocado on there. Is that scrambled egg? But
yes.
Very good eggs.
Yeah.
They are good eggs. Scrambled, a lot of pepper. Why is there some marmalade here?
Well, the other thing you can't see but will taste is underneath the avocado is the kind of secret weapon, which is a layer of gentleman's relish, Peyton Peperium.
Shit.
Anchovy paste. Do you like anchovies?
I like anchovies, but I think gentleman's relish is just a bit of an abomination.
Oh,
but
I love it.
It's one of those things that people buy and then it just sits.
See, for me, it's gone in a week. And also, can I just say, I hate the name. Gentleman's relish is very little dated, let's be honest.
But it just sounds a bit like it could be something quite rude. Doesn't it?
Wait, this is gentleman's relish.
Gentleman's relish. Just sounds a bit.
Can you imagine?
Do you know what I mean? It sounds a bit Carry On film.
Gentleman's relish. This is the anchovy paste version of gentleman's relish.
So what are you going to do with the marmalade?
So the marmalade is the other secret. So it's salty sweet. So basically I love scrambled egg with marmalade, but then occasionally I'll add gentleman's relish, occasionally I'll add avocados. This is the whole kind of shebang. But this acts as like a chutney.
Look, I can see a method. Hang on, here. I'm giving you yours.
All right.
How do I, do you eat this with a knife and fork? What do I do with the orange marmalade? Should I just put it on the side?
Put it on the side and then put like a nice, like treat it like a chutney. So my dad is a marmalade obsessive and has, and so I would usually have my dad's marmalade, but obviously
this is pretty good. Does he make marmalade?
Yeah, he makes a batch every year and I go home with it. Back to London with it, so I love it.
Oh my God. The marmalade's wobbling. It's just wobbling.
That is quite a lot of marmalade. It's good.
Right, hang on. You're never going to try and think about doing Celebrity MasterChef or anything.
Why? It's absolutely delicious.
It feels like you've got four different breakfasts and you're taking the plates back to the kitchen. When do you eat this?
This would be a, like a, this wouldn't be a breakfast thing. This would be a kind of late night. I mean, I think.
Do you know this, as so often happens on comfort eating.
Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, you start and you get past the initial Jesus Christ. And then it moves into something that's actually really compelling.
Isn't it really good? Yeah. It's psychological, I think, because you don't. Marmalade is such a sweet, such a treat. You don't ever think of it as a chutney. But the sharpness of the oranges, if you just think of it as a chutney.
Pass me the tea towel. I'm completely covered. It's one of those that you can't quite eat without getting it in your hairline.
Yeah.
You grew up in Yorkshire, a place absolutely renowned for its food. Wensleydale cheese, rhubarb, licorice, very understated Yorkshire pudding.
Mm-hmm.
What food takes you back to early years in the north?
Funny, it's not really those foods. I mean, when I was at school at the local primary, used to go, my mum and dad would be working because they worked quite far away and had a big commute. So I would go to this lady's house. She's called Liz Marshall. She's an absolutely amazing lady. And she would look after me and my sister. And she had grown up in Yorkshire all her life and was proper sort of old Yorkshire. And we would have like apple pies with slices of cheese. And we'd have like, every time we'd have a gravy meal, we'd have a slice of white bread just afterwards. I can't remember what it was called. It was some like gravy boat or something. Mm. And that was the best thing. You know, there'd always be a little bit of gravy left over in the pot. And so it would just be a plate, slice of white bread, no butter or anything, and just gravy all over it. It was absolutely delicious. So those things are that's like pre-10.
Do you still love gravy now?
Oh, see, yes. And I love making gravy. And I hate when anyone does my gravy, because it's never enough. And every single time I get a roast in a restaurant, before the food has hit my table in front of me, I'm like, could I have a little pot of extra gravy, please? And out with the horseradish and the mustard comes my little pot of extra gravy, and it just swims in it. I love it.
You were born in 1985. You grew up with your parents, Lavinia and Hugh, your sister Jessica. Give us a snapshot of young James. So what was your favorite toy?
Brio trains. Aww. The wooden ones, ones. I mean,
yeah.
And my sister has two little boys now, and I think they still have my Brio set, which is nice. I think my dad loves throwing stuff away, but we managed to save that one. Yeah, I loved trains. I was obsessed. And I think like a lot of kids, you sort of fit into the strange gender stereotypes. Tractors and trains. Anyway, I was obsessed. I wanted to be a train driver. I remember on the way to the train station once with my grandpa, and I was screaming so loud of excitement that he never really ticked me off, but he shouted at me like, calm down, because I was having like a panic attack over the idea of going and seeing a train. I was just, love trains.
You would have been a great train driver.
Thank you very much. I think so as well.
So what happened? You didn't pursue it, because they Britain always needs train drivers.
It does. Right now, we could go down that route, couldn't we? I don't know what happened with train driving. I never really got the opportunity. I went to a train station once when I was at school and got to blow the whistle. Maybe that was the end of the dream. But train driving was only a brief moment.
Give us a sense of family life. Like, there's you and your mum and your dad and your sister, and you're in this house, and is it fun? Is it noisy? Do you argue a lot?
All of those, I think.
Yeah,
it was definitely very fun and warm, and we were in the countryside, so, lots of outdoors. For some reason, it feels, I don't know what it's like to have a kid in in the area where I grew up. I hope it's the same, but at a very young age, I was able just to be free. Me and the other kids in the village, it's very kind of it's old-fashioned and kind of idyllic. We would just run around the fields and
just disappearing in the morning and just going.
Yeah, yeah. And just going swimming in the river. It's like Just William. It was weird.
You went home and you were hungry.
Yeah, went home when I was hungry, or I grazed my knee or whatever it was, And they would generally know where we were we weren't allowed to kind of go up to the top road where the cars were busy, but everywhere else was free rein. So it was pretty special.
You went up to that top road though, didn't you?
My friends lived on the other side of it.
There you go.
So I had to cross it every so often. And they were like the naughty guys. They were the ones who had the cigarettes and the booze. And so I had to sort of, yeah, they were great. I loved those guys.
You went to boarding school when you were 11. You spent 5 years at a school run by Benedictine monks. I think that there are seven distinct groups at every school the world over. You're either one of the jocks, one of the stoners, the teacher's pets, the prized intellectuals, the nerds, the poets, the goths, or the class clown. What are you?
Oh.
Would you like those categories again? Poet. I'm going to say poet. I'm going to say you're quite sensitive and you possibly wrote the odd poem.
I was quite keen and I definitely was in the more creative. I love theatre and I was member of the orchestra and so I was doing every school play I could and all that kind of stuff. So maybe the poet is the right space. I'd started to work hard at the end, so maybe I was a little bit of a nerd. I definitely wasn't a jock and I definitely wasn't in the kind of cool category. I became a bit of a stoner later on, but that was when I was at university and late. I think had I had that, well, that would probably chill me out a little bit. My school years were complicated, if I'm honest. I didn't have the greatest time. I was quite badly bullied for 5 years, so I sort of didn't really know. And I was also at boarding school, so I couldn't leave. Yeah. So it's complicated. And interestingly, segueing into food, it's weird when you're boarding because food becomes like huge because you don't have access to food. So you have your tuck and you have your access to the sort of sweet shop where you have like a 50p allowance every week or something. But food.
And if you're bloody unhappy, then it must be big deal.
It's a big deal,
these
gorgeous
moments of
treats.
Sugar.
Yeah. And I remember when pot noodles came out, it was huge at boarding school because it was like you had this independence. You didn't have to rely on the school meals because, you know, everything was so institutionalized, breakfast, lunch, dinner. Like you literally ate at a regimented time.
Going to a certain place, going to a hall where you would see people that you didn't want to see.
Yeah. And I mean, it's even worse. Every evening meal, it's the main, you know, like your kind of moment of sort of breaking bread a night, you would be in your year group. I mean, I've never said this really, but the group, you're with your, I think it was like 13 guys who are in your year. And the table was set such that the jocks would be at one end. And then it would be the stoners, the kind of cooler sort of like glass clowns. And then it would sort of go through the poets. And then it would end up with the sort of the nerds and the bullied people. And I was right at this end, not the jock end. And if I ever deigned to sit at the top end, I mean, they would have just laughed at me. They would have been like, what are you? They wouldn't even have, it was mad. It was so hierarchical and sort of structured. And so dinner times were charged for me. You know, there were this weird time when you were sitting with people who, I mean, most of them were great, but there were a couple who were not great. And that energy fed into my whole sort of, I had a really good time at school in some ways, but it was also complicated.
Absolutely get exactly what you're saying. I'm not sitting quietly going, I've no idea what he's talking about. I went to a comprehensive school in the north in the 80s and it was equally as hellish. Like there was some lovely people there and some people that I still to this day in 2023 think about daily and go,
oh yeah,
go, what was all that about? Like the determination of them to be like that every day must have been exhausting.
I think for me now, having moved on from it a long way and actually had some amazing, I've had a great therapist for the last 4 years and it's not from a place of drama or you know, I'm luckily not sort of suffering from depression or anything like that. But it's been really, really helpful just understanding what that was. And actually I've realized that boarding schools are really weird places. I mean, we're the only country who still send our kids away voluntarily. You know, most countries, if you've got some sort of discipline problem or the parents are in the army or whatever, then maybe they send them away. But we do it because it's this old-fashioned hangover from colonial era, really. And so you're stuck with these people and all these young kids are just deeply, deeply homesick and they're just lost. And some of them, that pain manifests itself in kind of being needy or rebellious, maybe the class clown. But some of them get angry, and rather than crying out for their mum, they just bully someone. Yes. And so these kids were just like me. We were all just looking for our mums. We were all missing our mums. But some of them got hold of the bit between their teeth and realised that they felt better if they were cruel to someone else. And I was unfortunately the victim of that.
Now, boarding schools and tuck boxes go together like Bubble and Squeak. If you opened the tuck box and you didn't know what was going to be in it, what is the one thing that your mum could have put in the tuck box that made you feel really loved?
50 quid.
No,
thanks, Mum. Yeah, it's cash. What would it be? I mean, my mum loves chocolate. But she loves shit chocolate. She has this big cupboard. It's just stacks of dairy milk and fruit and nut. And so fruit and nut for me and my sister, I know for her as well, that's such an association with my mum. So probably a bar of fruit and nut, because I love it as well, you know. I mean, I am actually now much more into 85%. I try and keep it to the dark chocolate, but yeah, chocolate for me.
I love the amount of guilt that you have around the fact that you actually just love
shit,
a
chocolate.
Lovely slab of Cadbury's dairy, what's it? Yeah, Cadbury's fruit and nut. Fruit and nut. How do you stop other people stealing your tuck box?
A padlock.
See, I'm getting stressed already. When you were back home during the holidays, was food a way of reconnecting with your family?
You see, that's another thing. Yes, massive. Because obviously when you get school food is school food. I mean, it was fine. It was institutional, big, yeah, mass-produced school food. And when you've had that every single day, every single meal, apart from occasional bits of toast you make in the kitchenette or a pot noodle or whatever, you get home and it's just heaven. And a lot of people ask me, did you not get really angry with your family because you went away to this thing and didn't really enjoy it? And I didn't. I mean, my mum and dad both went to those schools. And I think my sister and I know that my sister won't send her kids away, and I definitely won't either. I think that whole system is becoming out of date now. And I think that's a good thing in this country. People are going, wait, let's not maybe do that anymore. That's not great for the kids. But one thing it did, I think, leave me with is a really good relationship with my family, because every single time I went home, it was absolutely sacred. I would eke out every moment when I was there. It wasn't that I was, most kids, the parents having to persuade their kids to have a sit down meal. Let's all sit down. I was desperate for that. So every Sunday lunch I got, I would, it was magical.
Religion feels like a theme as you were growing up. Ampleforth College, Catholic school. It prides on giving its students, and I quote, a spiritual compass for life. I love the way that you laughed then. And then after graduating, you go off and read theology at Cambridge.
Mm.
How big a role did God play for you in your teenage years?
It's quite a big question. Yeah, I mean, big in a way. You know, because at the time when I was at that school, and like everyone at that age, I was a bit confused and a bit lost. And I had this other thing where I was some people were making my life a bit difficult. And so add all those things together, add in the fact that you're a bit homesick. But, and also I was also very aware that I was very privileged and I was having this incredible education and I was accessed to all this amazing resources and stuff. So you're a bit what the hell? And then the framework within that confusion is incredibly certain. It knows exactly what it is. It's this ancient institution, and it's saying to you, wake up in the morning and if you've got problems, pray. If you are feeling good about something, you're feeling full of awe. I mean, it was a really beautiful school. It was in the middle of the countryside, and I would I'd wake up and from my dormitory or in the sixth form, you have your own room, and I'd open the window, and often the whole valley would be full of this mist. And it really was it's a very, very beautiful part of the world. And so then you go downstairs and then the housemaster, who's a monk, Father Gabriel, would say, right, let's all give thanks. And, you're 15 and you're going, wow, thanks very much. And, now all this sort of, everyone's now trying to find their space, their self-help space, finding places to be grateful and give gratitude. I had that every day, and whatever you think about Catholicism and all the problems and complications that it has. There's something really wonderful about waking up every day and just going, thanks very much, or maybe help me out right now. You know, I had a channel to something, and I mean, I got very religious. I became like really wrapped up in it. Yeah. But I think partly because I was having a bit of a tough time and I found a lot of solace in it, you know. And I had this amazing man called Father Peter who I'd go and chat to, and I'd be like, I'm not sure what's going on. And he'd be like, it's all good, don't worry about it. So he became kind of an intentional therapist. And then I became, got older and got interested in it, and then went away from school and left and let rip, found freedom and autonomy, and was, and also found confidence. And also went away to, when I went, left school, I went to like, spent most of a year in South Asia, in India and Nepal. And I was really interested in Buddhism and Hinduism and Eastern religions. And so my theology degree became much more of a sort of outsider looking in at religion rather than it coming from the place of faith. I wasn't one of those people studying it with the intention of going into the church. I was just really interested in it.
So you're interested in Eastern religion. You explore the world traveling. But with this newfound autonomy, I mean, were there like full moon parties and dodgy tattoos?
So that's what happened when I went away, having been pretty much, it was, there were girls there, but not many. It was an all boys school, pretty much. It was like a handful of girls. And I mean, I know that the whole gap year thing, changing you and giving you, but it really gave me confidence. And I was also able just to like let rip. I basically went, what did all the stuff which you meant to do as a teenager in 1 year. For about a month, I didn't wear any shoes because I lost my flip-flops broke. And I was like, who needs shoes? So I was walking in and out of, like, honestly, in buses across India. I spent 4 days on a train going from the top of the most northernmost town on the Nepali-Indian border, Gorakhpur, down to Trivandrum. I mean, I had no plan. I was just sitting with no shoes, eating samosas. It was nuts, but I had the time of my life.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
In 2010, age 25, you are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. It means your body doesn't naturally make insulin, the hormone that processes the sugar that you eat. How does diabetes affect your eating and your enjoyment of food?
It obviously affects my eating significantly in the sense that I have to be aware of what I'm eating. And I have to eat more sugar than I would like in order to keep it balanced. And I have to be aware of eating a lot of refined sugar all at once, because it will mean that my sugar levels rise quickly and it's harder to control. And then it spins me out for the rest of the day. So the answer to the question is, I try and not let it control what I eat. And I generally will eat puddings, eat desserts, eat chocolate.
Are you a good diabetic, or are you one of those that plays fast and loose?
I'm not the best, but I'm pretty good. My mum and my sister both have diabetes.
Okay.
So I'm a family, apart from my dad, who's the weird freak of the family, he has a normal functioning pancreas, the weirdo. but the rest of us, I've grown, and my sister who had it first has been, she's my younger sister, but she's been an amazing role model because she lived very much by that mantra of, you know, not letting it control you, you control it. And so, you know, when we would have a dessert, and we do love our chocolate on my family, and my sister would tuck in and she would enjoy it. And occasionally her sugars would go a little bit out of whack, but she would bring it back into control. And you sort of just get on with it.
You went to drama school. In fact, you went to RADA.
I went to RADA, yeah.
Royal Academy of the Dramatic Arts. And often actors, they slog away for years getting rejected before they get work. Not you. You didn't graduate from drama school because steady work started coming in. What do you consider your lucky break if you had to pick? Tell us that moment.
I mean, I guess the first job is a lucky break in a sense. You know, I did a play called Posh at the Royal Court, which took me out of drama school halfway through my final year. And that definitely set me off on a great trajectory because it was a professional job. It was a great high profile play and everyone loved it. And
it's a difficult subject, Posh.
It was. I mean, we were doing it in the court, Royal Court, which is in South Kensington. And it's basically a skewering of like the Bullingdon Club. A lot of our audience probably were in, or at least had friends who were in the Bullingdon Club. So, you know, it was quite interesting having an audience, some like probably very progressive left wing theatre goers. And then you had like, oh, do you fancy a night at the theatre? Kind of popping along with, you know, their partners. And then, so, you know, it was interesting hearing the audience laughing at different things, you know, when the satire kind of changed its target. And then obviously, and then halfway through our run, David Cameron, it went from, David Cameron got into power. And so our Prime Minister was suddenly an ex-Bullingdon member. It suddenly became incredibly poignant, this play we were doing.
You do Posh. Things start to go really well. You're working really hard. I hear that you're playing just as hard as well. You're young, fresh, upcoming actor. You're in this play everyone's talking about. I always wonder that if I stumbled into the right back room of a Soho boozer around this time, finding the cast of a play hanging out after hours, you're drinking dirty martinis long into the night. Is it like that? Paint me a picture.
I mean, it's pretty good. Has someone from Posh been on the podcast? Certainly that first play, yeah. Like we were all young, not kids, we were like mid-20s, and we'd all got our first paycheck. And it was a West End paycheck. It was Royal Court, but it was still pretty good. You know, it was still like, a few hundred quid a week. I mean, it was enough. And we were all this, we were this like band, you know, it was like being in a sports team or a band. Like we would do our thing every night.
All male cast. Almost.
Fiona Button. Yeah, there's a couple of them.
But a young men.
Yeah.
So of course.
Yeah. And like lovely men as well, really lovely. You know, like Kit Harrington, it was his first job, Tom Myson, Harry Haddon Payton, like really lovely, good guys. Henry Lloyd Hughes. I mean we would go from set feeling amazing. Because I don't know if people who hadn't seen the play, like there were moments when we would break from the dinner. Talk about food. It was a feast. We were eating a 10-bird roast. Bird inside a bird inside a bird inside a bird. Roasted. I mean, it was nuts. Drinking wine, downing wine, coming up, doing like Jay-Z raps to the audience, dressed in tails. I mean, it was like you felt fucking amazing.
Was it a real bird inside a bird that you ate, or was it just a plastic one that they brought?
It was probably a bit of chicken.
Because I honestly find those things eerie.
They're disgusting.
But I think that they're an amazing, they really nail a mindset.
Gluttony.
Yes, introducing a bird inside a bird instead of a bird.
It's grotesque.
Smaller than the other, thinking that combination of meat somehow denotes luxury.
Yeah.
So at the end of the night, so you're pumped up, you're doing rap on stage, and then you all go out somewhere together.
Every night we'd roll out of the front, the Royal Court bar would close, some people would have friends in, we'd roll out the front, we'd wave down like three black cabs, we'd go straight to Black's, we'd order like three or four bottles of the house red wine. We drink that. Blacks, back in those days, it was much more sort of loose.
Please explain Blacks to people that have never been there. I have done some very stupid things in Blacks.
Blacks is like the quintessential, like old-fashioned sort of dark corners and fire. You know, there's hardly any. There's always weird art on the walls, very little light, real fires burning and... what was his name? This wonderful kind of host who would sort of, he took a shine to us all. We all had membership because when you're doing a West End show, you get membership. But it's like this tiny little kind of old Edwardian nook, isn't it, in Soho.
The sofas that are like beds.
Yeah.
Like so you end up really hammered.
Horizontal.
And then you're kind of in bed.
Yeah, you're right. With a
and
fire.
It's like 2 o'clock in the morning and you're basically lying in bed with a load of strangers and you're thinking this is amazing.
It's amazing. And we were just behind those curtains, but just 10 dudes just like telling each other how wonderful we were.
(laughs) 2014, you're cast as Tommy Lee Royce, the villain in the BBC's much-loved drama Happy Valley. Okay, this character, probably one of the most truly despicable characters that's ever been on television. You are absolutely lovely.
Thanks.
How hard is it to do that? I'm fascinated by you doing this character because you inhabit a kind of... You inhabit a space that I only saw in the biggest psychopaths that I hung around with in the northwest of England. I didn't have any choice to hang around with them. They were just in the community somewhere.
Right.
I don't know how you do that. How hard is that? Where did you get it from?
I mean, I have to credit Sally, who gave me the best role ever. I mean, she, you know, we actors are only looking for good character and good writing, and she is the best. Like, she's amazing, like, no doubt. I mean, someone said to me recently, directors, if you can just actors, if you're just still, you can fill in a lot with everything, all the music and the edit and the grade. I mean, I'm proud of Tommy. I'm not going to say it was all, you know, kind of created around me. Definitely feel like I went somewhere with him, and I had an amazing amount of help, both through Sally's amazing writing. BBC put me in touch with criminal psychologists. I mean, I did a lot of work. I knew that the stakes were high, and I wanted to do as good a job as I could. Sally gives you a lot of prescription in the stage directions. She's always asking me in a lovely way, in a really kind of... you know, she sets you free by saying, let's find some playfulness. And she always wants him to feel quite boyish. So on the one hand, he's this monster who can, you know, master manipulator. But on the other hand, he's a kid. So in that first episode of episode one in the last series, you know, I was playing around with that cup. And that was just something which we found in the moment through Sally just saying, go and have fun, be boyish. So you find a lot of it in the moment and in the lead up to it. But also, it's like, it's really fun. I mean, it's really, really exciting because the freedom that man, that headspace gives me, being the complete antithesis to me, has been a joy.
Of course, you are from Yorkshire.
And I'm from Yorkshire.
So, of course, you can...
The accent's there, yeah. I had an accent. I had a strong Yorkshire accent until I was about 11, 12, yeah.
What?
Yeah, there's a video of me playing Joseph in The Nativity, and I'm... No, proper. Is Ready Roman in, Mary? No, fuck off. Or not.
Do you not just feel like just going back to that accent? Would it just not be? Like, just let it go.
Yeah. Occasionally.
What about when you've had like 3 or 4 glasses of wine? Does it not just start coming
The only word which it comes back in is I say, are you confused? I hit the word, I hit con, and not confused. I say, I'm feeling a bit confused. I don't know why. That's the only... It's the first syllable of a word like that which hit Yorkshire.
Last year, you got engaged to your girlfriend, Imogen Poots, who you met while you were in a play together. In a nutshell, how did you woo her?
She often says this. She's like, it was the moment we were in a rehearsal and... We were doing a timeline of the characters we were in, and she was being quite diligent, which isn't necessarily in her character, but she was being quite, you know, like, I think at this point I left school and I started, you know, university. And then when I left university, I think I moved into my flat. And I was like with these, because we had these little tags we had to write on, you know, put it on the wall in the timeline. And I was just writing like, I reckon we went to the Maldives. Don't you think? Let's just fucking go to the Maldives. Yeah. And then I reckon we just like, we went for a little weekend, a little naughty weekend in Paris here. And she just really enjoyed that. And that was like in the first week of rehearsals. I think that was the point when she was like, oh, this guy's... I think she thought silly. I was someone I'm not. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think people do that sometimes. I think she's always saying to me, like, just relax a bit. Like, don't worry. I think sometimes with the press thing, I have worried about not offending. Yeah. And as a result, I can come over as a little bit nice and a bit, maybe not serious, but a bit earnest. And I'm not. I think I'm a bit maybe the clown. If I'd had the freedom to be who I wanted to be at school, I think I may have been the clown. She's certainly the clown.
Yes.
She's a clown through and through. She's a clown. We've both quite got into clowning recently, actually. So the actual school of clowning.
What?
Yeah, really amazing.
Hang on. Are you going to join clown school?
Yes, going to clown class. Yeah, going to do a week.
See, this is thespians for you, isn't it? Like, literally. I'm busy. You know, like, just give thespians any encouragement and you lot will be walking into an invisible wind, like doing things like that, throwing buckets of water, but they've got glitter in them. Is it that kind of clowning?
No, that's mime. Well, that's mime, the hands and the window, but then...
Well, I mean, I'm thinking about clowns with flappy shoes.
No. So no. Clowning...
No?
Clowning in the sort of pure form is like Lecoq or Philippe Goliath. It's that yes. Kind of... it's basically everyone has a clown. Everyone has a persona within them, which is, I think, ultimately free. It's like but it's also ugly and it's sad and it's without all of the kind of shine and performative parts of us. You know, the kind of desperate wanting to please and be liked. And you find your clown, and part of it is just stripping everything away and being as honest and as vulnerable as you possibly can be. So a clown teacher, and this is all from here, so I haven't done it yet, done a little bit at drama school, but a clown teacher, you'll stand there and you'll try and make people laugh, and they'll just be like, no, it's not funny. It's not funny. Get off stage. It's not funny. It's not funny. And you get weaker and more lost and more sort of vulnerable and like wretched. And at your absolute lowest, where you're like, then everyone starts to laugh. You're like, there's your clown. It's like therapy. That great.
Later this year, you're back on stage in the West End in an adaptation of Hania Yanagihara's best-selling novel, A Little Life. You've been doing more screen than stage in the last few years. Do you plan, as an actor, a strategy for your career? Or is it just opportunism?
I thought about this recently. I think... if you have too much of a strategy in this industry, you're causing yourself problems, because it is so transient and fickle and there's so many variables. And Judy Dench said something really wonderful recently in an interview. She's asked, what's the secret to a successful career? And she's like, to be honest, it's just being in the right place at the right time. Like, you've just got to be a bit lucky. You've got to be seen by someone who matters, who has the power to put you in something, which then other people see, and it just starts the ball rolling. And there are so many actors who are brilliant who don't work, and there are so many actors who do work who are horrible. But you just, it's a lot of luck, and you can strategize, but it will very unlikely go exactly as you want it to go. I mean, you do put things in place to give you some sort of control. And for me, that has been, you know, making sure they come back to theatre, which is always a bit of a sacrifice because it doesn't pay as well. And I'm renovating a house right now, and this play couldn't have come at the worst time because it's not like a TV sort of wage, but that's fine.
No, it's underfloor heating for you right now.
Well, no furniture for sure. No furniture, no curtains. I'm not even joking as well.
What are you going to sit on? You're just going to get a couple of deck chairs from...
I think it's going to be,
very, very small IKEA, like, couch.
Just a futon, and that's pretty much it.
Happy Valley, back on our screens for its third and final series right now. Absolutely unmissable. Sunday evening telly. When you're on your own couch with comfies on, watching a box set, what is your go-to treat? Sweet treat.
I love chocolate, so... I'll have one of those coconut chocolate pots. You know, those like ones you get in Tesco's or whatever. They're like these kind of basically like a chocolate yogurt, but they're like coconut based.
Like a goo pot.
Yeah, it's like a goo, but it's smaller. Or one of those kind of...
Is it in a glass jar?
No, it's not. It's not as posh as that. It's like a little... It's like, I mean, back in the day, it would be a Rolo yogurt. You know, those Rolo yogurts, they were the bang. They were amazing. I mean, it's chocolate. It's all the way. It's 70%. It's 85%. It's the chocolate orange from Lindt with the orange and the kind of almond bits.
Oh, sounds delicious.
Orange chocolate is the best. my girlfriend and I, at the end of every meal, we'd like, we're not having dessert, but then we'll pull out, we've got this chocolate drawer in our house, the house we used to have, and it was just full to the brim of like half-eaten bars, because it feels bad to like finish a bar. So we have like 10 Tonys, like a couple of Tonys, a couple of green and blacks, a couple of, yeah. And we just lay this huge pile of half-eaten chocolate bars in front of us and just nibble away, yeah.
I love that two actors share in a house and you've just got loads of half-eaten bars of chocolate because you can't let yourself have the full bar.
I know. Or if it's a really good bar, you don't want to finish it. So you keep it and like keep, you know, just a little bit for that day.
James Norton, thank you for comfort eating with me. It's the final episode of season 4. What an absolute send-off.
It's been my pleasure. It really has. I've loved it. Best podcast ever.
This episode of Comfort Eating was produced by Jack Claremont. The executive producer is Lucy Greenwell. The music was written by Axel Kakutier. Mixing and sound design was by Solomon King. If you like Comfort Eating, then please go and leave us a review, and you can follow or subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And use the hashtag ComfortEatingPod to get in touch about the podcast or share your own comfort eating delights.
This is The Guardian.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.